We open Fresh Air today with the State Street Rag with Howard Armstrong on mandolin. That 1934 recording inspired a documentary on musician Howard Armstrong, and in a moment we'll meet the director of the film, Terry Zwigoff. Also this afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll feature a National Press Club address by Alan Shepard, who was the first American astronaut to travel in space. Monday is the 25th anniversary of his history-making flight. He'll give a retrospective of the U.S. space program and take questions about the shuttle disaster. That's at 4 o'clock. Well, with me now is Terry Zwigoff, the director and producer of the much-praised new film Louie Bluey, a documentary about Howard Armstrong, the 76-year-old musician who we just heard from. Armstrong plays violin and mandolin and is one of the surviving practitioners of the music popularized by the black string bands in the teens and 20s. Armstrong recorded but never made it big. He spent many years playing medicine shows, ethnic bars, traveling around Appalachia, and passing the hat in city streets. But in the early 70s, Armstrong and his longtime friends mandolinist Carl Martin and guitarist Ted Bogan were rediscovered, and their group toured the folk festival and university coffeehouse circuit under the name Martin, Bogan, and Armstrong. Armstrong is a natural storyteller, and his tales provide the narrative for the film about him. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin called the film as colorful, lively, and garrulous as the man it describes, and she praised the director for neither sanitizing nor sentimentalizing Howard Armstrong. Director Terry Zwigoff has been collecting music of the 20s and 30s for about 20 years. He also plays music inspired by that period with the band R. Crumb and his Cheap Suit Serenaders, led by cartoonist R. Crumb. Zwigoff plays cello and mandolin, and he's the former staff photographer and advice to the lovelorn columnist for R. Crumb's magazine, Weirdo Magazine. He's brought some of his favorite records to play for us today. His film Louie Bluey will be screened through Sunday at the International House, Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. There will be a concert in conjunction with the film. Howard Armstrong and guitarist Ted Bogan, who've played together since 1930, will be joined by slide guitarist James Sun Thomas. So that's at 8 o'clock Saturday evening. The film will be screened through Sunday at the International House, 3701 Chestnut Street. For more information, you can call 387-5125. That's 387-5125, extension 222. Welcome, Terry, to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Tell us how that record that we just heard, which was in your collection, inspired the movie.
Well, I live in San Francisco, and I was over at a collector's house in Oakland. This guy mostly collected jazz records, and I brought over some records to trade because I like blues stuff better than jazz. And he said, "Well, here's a record you might like. I know you play the mandolin. I found this thing. It's called State Street Rag, and it's by this guy Louie Bluey." And I didn't know who Louie Bluey was, but he played me about 10 seconds of it, and I immediately took the needle off it because I knew I won, and I didn't want the guy to change his mind. If he kept hearing it, he might realize it's a great record, you know. So I said, "Okay, well, I'll trade you for this." And I gave him some, like, Duke Ellington record or something, took the thing home, and played it about 10 times in a row. I couldn't believe how great it was. You know, it was the best mandolin playing I'd ever heard. And at that time, I'd been playing mandolin about 5 years or so, and so I tried to figure it out. And the more I tried to figure it out, the more impressed I became with this guy's ability. So sort of in the back of my mind, I'd always had this mystique about this record. I later found out there was only one other known copy of the thing some collector had in New York. It's extremely rare. I'd already been offered $2,500 for the thing. It's really crazy. But anyway, I'd always wanted to do a film about black string bands and jug bands, and I could never really think of a way to do it without making a real academic sort of film, like most of these folklore films you see. I don't know. My main complaint with the whole thing is they're pretty antiseptic and they're just boring. You know, I don't even like documentary films really. You know, and I couldn't really think of a good way to pull this off. Everybody I knew was, who'd been playing in this tradition, was dead or too old to be able to play any good. And I'd seen this band Martin, Bogan, and Armstrong before. I wasn't particularly impressed with them. I thought they were okay, but I didn't think they were great or anything. It was certainly like a shadow of what they used to be in the 20s. And I had no idea that Howard Armstrong was this guy Louie Bluey, but I later found out by doing this elaborate detective work that Ted Bogan was the guy that backed him up on this old 78. And Ted Bogan, when I finally met him, I said, "Who's Louie Bluey that 50 years ago you backed up on guitar on this one record?" He said, "Well, it's Howard Armstrong." And I didn't believe it because I looked at Armstrong. He looks about 45 years old, you know, and he's actually 76. But I went up to him and I showed him this old record. I said, "Is this you? Are you this guy?" He said, "Oh yeah, that's me." And he was such an incredible character that I knew he was the really the catalyst to tie this whole film together and make an interesting sort of character study as well as a history of this music and not put the audience to sleep. You know, it's a lot of sex and a lot of laughs.
A lot of dirty lyrics.
Some dirty lyrics. I just tried to keep it moving. You know.
What, as you say, he's a very colorful character. What are some of the things about his character that attracted you to him as a subject for the movie?
I guess mostly he sort of had this sense of humor that I like. You know, the first time I met him, I think I wound up talking to him for about 4 hours. It was after a concert that him and Bogan played in San Francisco at some college or something, and I realized how entertaining the guy was because it was about 4 hours, and I hadn't even bothered to sit down. I stood the entire 4 hours while he was sitting there just talking to the guy. It was incredibly funny. He kept me laughing the whole time. You know, I guess that's what attracted me the most about him. And then the other thing was he's so articulate about it. He's this guy that was old enough to have been there, and he's still able to talk about it, which is really unusual. Most of these old blues musicians you meet who are that old, who were actually playing in the golden age of when this music was a vibrant force, or they either drank too much or their health is so bad they've led such a hard life that they don't have it together enough to tell you about what it's like, and this guy did.
You told us that you don't like most documentaries and that you think most documentaries about blues musicians have been a dry and kind of sanitized.
Yeah, so this sort of precious, namby-pamby sort of tone to them, you know, it really puts me off.
What did you try to do differently?
I don't know. I don't know what I tried. I didn't know how to make a film. It was the first film I ever made, which I guess turned out to be an advantage because I was so afraid of directing my first film that I really wanted to do my homework. So I went out to the video store and I got every black documentary I could, watched television on, you know, public television, every black documentary I could, every feature film I could. And I just tried to learn basically what not to do is all I would, you know. I don't think I saw a single film I liked with the exception of Say Amen, Somebody, you know, and I didn't like that all that much. I thought even that went along those lines, a sort of condescending, sort of rarefied air to it, you know.
Can you give, can you list three things that you swore you would not do in your movie that you'd learned were terrible through renting all these other films?
Well, one thing I made a vow to do was not have any scholars appear on camera, you know, at a chalkboard with a graph showing the migration of urban blacks or kind of, you know, rural black people to the cities, you know, just stuff like that. You know, it's ridiculous to have that. It's not, you know, you're not making a film, you're making some kind of classroom lesson or something, and nobody wants to see that. You're going to put people to sleep with that stuff. People have such a short attention span these days that my editor, who's a great editor, you know, would tell me, Howard Armstrong's a great storyteller. It's one of the highlights of this film is his ability to tell a story well, and he tells quite a number of them. One of the problems is some of his stories, in order to set up and tell with all the details, take about 3 minutes. And my editor, you know, we'd have these stories in this film. My editor said, "You can't have this in the film. We got to cut this. It's too long." I said, "What do you mean it's too long? It's 3 minutes." He said, "Oh, people's attention span will not last over 60 seconds watching people talking in a film, talking heads, you know." And so you'd have to just make these compromises because of modern life. You know, people are interested in watching MTV, where everything changes every 4 seconds. You watch any TV commercial now, and everything changes within, you know, 5 or 6 seconds. It's really scary.
So what was your answer to that? Would you take out that story or just put in more visual changes through it?
I made compromises in that direction. I didn't always, you know, follow her advice. We sort of fought it out. You know, I left in certain stories, but she was right. You know, I realized later, a lot, I travel around the country. Oftentimes this film gets shown at colleges or theaters, and I sit in the back and watch, you know, and I see what people respond to the most, and they have pretty short attention spans, I gotta say, you know, for the most part, that when there's short little funny bits, they really respond to it, and when it's like a really rich sort of detailed mosaic that this guy can paint, it's like, you know, they're sort of, you're losing them.
Did you ever feel in an awkward position being a relatively young white man from the North doing a movie about an old 76-year-old black musician from the South?
Of course, yeah. I always felt completely uncomfortable about it. And it got to the point where it's just like so absurd that I just didn't even care about it anymore. You know, it's like I just try not to make those mistakes I saw other white guys make to make these films. Actually, to tell you the truth, the worst films are made by blacks about other black people and about this culture that I saw. They're really these like sort of kid gloves on approach, you know, that you just don't get anything out of it. You don't get a feeling for what these people are like. And I just figured, what the heck, after a while, you know. I knew these guys without the camera on, and I'd spent a lot of time with them, hanging out and playing music with them, and had a feeling for what they're really like. And when the camera started rolling, I immediately lost that feeling. As soon as like other people came in the room with cameras, they immediately put on this sort of polite face, you know, and it took every bit of ingenuity I had to get rid of that. You know,
What did you do to get rid of it?
Well, for instance, the first day we were filming. I knew this. I wanted them to play State Street Rag in the film, right? So I said, "Okay, Howard and Ted, I want you to play
that's
this."
That's the song that we opened with.
Yeah, can you guys play this tune still? Okay, so they're sitting around the kitchen and they're tuning up, and Yank Rachel was there, another mandolin player, and he looked this really incredible character, and he's sitting there, and I figured, now what would he be doing? And when we started filming, he was sitting there politely at this table pretending to listen and pay attention. At the end of the tune, he says, "That's very good. That's real good," you know. And I think, God, this is about as phony as a $3 bill. Then why don't we do it again and you guys play the music? In reality, I'm thinking, what would Yank Rachel be doing? He'd be probably laying down on the couch snoozing or, you know, reading a magazine or something. So I'm looking around for a magazine to have him read. I mean, the whole thing is staged. It's not even a documentary film, right? I hate to be saying this before people see it, but it's what happened. And so I'd look around for a magazine for anything. What would be funny, you know, or what would be appropriate, or what would be real anyway? Well, would he be reading Ebony, Reader's Digest? I've got all these magazines to pick from. And there's this magazine that hit me as like what he'd be reading. It was a copy of this magazine called Income Opportunities. It had like a big picture of a pot of gold with a rainbow ending in it on the cover. And it exactly seemed to sum up this guy's personality to me, you know. So I thought, okay, so I'll have him reading this sitting there. And at the end of the film, I actually wrote these lines for him to say. You know, I said, well, why don't you say this? Because this is what I experienced him saying in real life. And
what was the line?
Oh, I don't know. He'd like insult these guys when they're finished. It's basically what he actually thought. He thought they stunk, you know. He'd say something like, they'd say, "How do you like that, Mr. Rachel?" And he'd say, "I don't think too much of it," or "I have heard better," you know, or something like that. And the whole thing like just struck me as the only way out. You know, I couldn't stand like seeing this like phony sort of thing take place, which in reality would be considered more cinema verite. But to my way of thinking, it was actually a truer picture of what was going on to stage everything and make it phony. So it's actually not a documentary film. It's a feature film, a scripted film with using amateur actors to play themselves who improvise a lot.
Is that something you want people to know?
Not especially, because most people don't realize that.
It's certainly being billed as a documentary film.
Yeah, and I think it sort of ruins that if you tell them that before they see the film. I guess I shouldn't have gone into it. But I don't know. It's hard for me to be objective about it. You know, I've seen the film 500 times. I don't know. I just try to keep it entertaining, and I don't know. Just try to keep stuff in there that I like, good laughs and a lot of great music, you know. I really think that in any film the most important thing to do is to have interesting characters, and so I really tried to work on that. That's really where I put most of my energies.
The film that we're talking about is Louie Bluey, and it's about Howard Armstrong, who's a 76-year-old mandolinist and violinist and has been playing with string bands since the 1920s. My guest is the director and producer of the film, Terry Zwigoff, and the movie is being screened now at the International House. It will be there through Sunday. And Armstrong is going to play with Ted Bogan this Saturday night at 8 o'clock in a concert in conjunction with the movie. For more information about any of this, you can call 387-5125. We open the show with a, 1934 recording of Armstrong.
Uh-huh.
Why don't we listen to something that they recorded while you were filming?
Okay.
This was done for the film. We're going to hear "Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams." Now, tell us about the setting for this. Is this a song they do a lot, or
they'd never played this before? it happened to be a
more verite
a favorite tune of mine. I actually just wanted to hear the tune, and they'd played a bunch of tunes. We're trying to get this ending shot of the film. That showed the Chicago skyline, and the camera pulls back and we roll the credits over. And I just wanted to play a good tune. I didn't care what the tune was, but I want the lyrics to have something to do with the theme of this film, whatever that may be. But I couldn't think of anything, and they played about three or four tunes, and none of them sounded very good. And I said, "Do you guys know this tune, Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams? I had a record of it by Louis Armstrong. I really like this tune." And they'd never played it together before. They said, "Well, let's see. Do you know that? Do you know that? What key do we play it?" And they just started playing. It was great, you know. So I actually worked out. So I got lucky.
So Howard Armstrong is featured on, I think, mandolin and vocals on this. Uh-huh. Is that right? And you want to see who else is on it?
Banjo Ikey Robinson, who used to play with Jabbo Smith back in the 20s, plays banjo. Howard's son Tom Armstrong's playing bass. Ted Bogan's playing guitar. And I think that's it on this particular cut.
This is from an album that's the soundtrack of the film Louie Bluey.
For the sun to shine through, there's nothing really more that you can do. Wrap your troubles in dreams, dream all your troubles away. Castles may tumble, that fate after all. Life is really funny that way. Ain't no need to drama, smile when it falls. When you king, queen for a day, and I want you. Just remember that the sunshine always follows a rainy day. Wrap your troubles in dreams, dream your troubles away. I get a little taste. Just for a day. Wrap all your troubles in dreams.
Yeah, wrap them up.
Dream all your troubles away. Now you wait for that old sun to shine through. Honey, child, ain't nothing more than you can do. Wrap your troubles in dreams, that's all. Dream your troubles away. Well, castles, they're gonna tumble. That fate after all. Life is really funny just that way. Ain't no need to crumble now, just smile when it falls. And when you came for a day, then it weren't you?
Yeah, man, I hear you.
Just remember that the sunshine always falls a rainy day. Wrap your troubles in dreams and keep your troubles away. Thank you.
Howard Armstrong featured on mandolin and vocals on that recording of Wrap Your Troubles and Dreams, which is from the soundtrack of the film Louie Bluey about Howard Armstrong. My guest is the director and producer of the film, Terry's Wygoff. You know, there is a part in the movie where Armstrong brings out, from under lock and key, his book, The ABCs of Pornography, which have these very cartoon-like, explicit drawings in it that... How did you know about this?
I had no idea. We were a year into filming and making this film, and he pulls this book out of nowhere and showed me off camera. He said he knew that I liked his. He had a couple paintings and drawings that he'd done that were, they ranged from terrible to great. You know, his art was really erratic, and because there were these few great things in there, I kept bugging him. Do you have anything more? Let me see some more stuff you've done. And finally, he brings out this book called The ABCs of Pornography. It's about 200 pages long, all full color, hand-drawn, handwritten, incredible, like museum piece, you know, should be at the Smithsonian or something under lock and key. And shows it to me. And I'm just going crazy over this book. And he says, you know, I've shown that book to like three or four people, and they all just think I'm sick, you know. They think this is disgusting. You're the first person that's really liked it. So you got to show this in the film. We got to have this in the film. He says, oh, no, no way. I can't have this in the film. And he kept refusing to let me show this in the film. And only way I got him to do it was that we had just finished some interview. He was talking to Ikey Robinson about what it was like to play in a medicine show or something. And they were taking a little break. And I just pulled the book out, and I said, you know, Howard, Ikey's never seen this. Why don't you show this to him? And the camera was rolling, and Howard knew it was rolling. He's a pretty hip guy, and he didn't care at that point. He said, what the hell? And he showed it. And it was great because Ikey had never seen this book before, and he's reacting completely genuinely to this. He's completely absorbed. He didn't even know the camera was there after a while, you know. It was an incredible document. And I also wanted to get the book in because I'd never – all these other films about black musicians and – black culture, they always treat black people, especially old black people, like they're completely sexless individuals, you know. And Howard, you know, sex is a big part of his life. The guy's 76, but he's got 10 girlfriends all over the country. I hope that saying that doesn't get him into too much trouble with some of them. But I just really thought it was crazy not to have that whole side of him in there. I think it's crazy other films don't go into that.
How did you get interested in music of the 20s and 30s?
I met this guy, Al Dodge, who's in the Cheap Suit Serenaders, a really eccentric guy. He used to lay in bed all day in his pajamas and play mandolin, laying down while he watched bad TV. And he had a big collection of 78s. Every time I'd go over there, he'd want to play this 78. And I said, God, you know, I was thinking to myself, God, I hate this stuff. This sounds like old cartoon music to me. I can't stand this stuff. And so they start to grow on me, you know. Every once in a while, he'd play like a really great record, and I'd be asking him to play it again the next time it was over, and I got hooked.
So I get that reaction a lot because I play a lot of music from the 20s and 30s on this program, and people frequently refer to it as that cartoon music.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard because you have this image in your head, you know, this sort of pigeonholed in that department, and you really want you really have to listen to it. Musicians are more open to it than other people, you know, because they're actually listening to what the musical instruments are doing. You know, that's a pretty tasteful solo, or that's a good chord or something, you know. But most people aren't musicians; just listen to it, and the overall superficial impression is, oh yeah, old cartoon music, you know.
So, what had you been listening to before discovering that period?
As a kid and in college, I never listened to any music, and I was real alienated, and I'm sure it really screwed up my whole personality growing up because all my friends were listening to the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or whatever was big, you know, and I hated all this stuff. I hated Bob Dylan, I hated the Rolling Stones, hated the Beatles, you know, and then like I always felt sort of cheated because everywhere I went, people were so happy to hear Creedence Clearwater or something, you know, or much worse bands for that matter, and
you must have been one very popular guy.
Yeah, I was completely unpopular. Girls wouldn't talk to me, mostly because of this music thing, too, you know.
Were you playing an instrument then?
Not really. You know, I had a guitar. I sort of diddled away on it. You know, there were like a few guys. I liked like Buddy Holly, and I didn't even like him that much. You know, I sort of liked him, but... And I stumbled onto this jug band music and black country music. I really went hog wild. I was so obsessed with it because I've been starved for music for 20 years, you know. The sad story.
Well, let's play something that you're featured on, and this features the band Arc Rum and his Cheap Suit Serenaders.
Uh-oh.
We're going to hear a medley. Tell us what's in it.
It's a medley by a completely obscure white hillbilly band called the Collier Trio that recorded four records back in the late 20s. I don't know, it's like some little parlor band, but I happen to like these couple of tunes. One's called, I think, Napoleon March, a couple of marches. One's called the Ben-Hur March, and it goes into Napoleon March.
And you're featured on mandolin on
I'm
this.
Playing mandolin, and Crumb's playing guitar, and...
And the guy who used to watch TV, watch bad
Al
TV,
Dodge.
And
I don't think he's on this. I don't think he's playing on it. I think there's maybe a steel guitar not doing much in the background. It's really me and Crumb. Yeah. Crumb likes this kind of music more than the rest of the guys in the band. Me and him sort of like country music more. The other guys like jazz more, they like more sophisticated stuff, like real simple stuff. So hope you like it. I don't know.
Okay, and my guest is Terry Zweigoff. We'll hear him featured on mandolin on this recording with R. Crumb and his Cheap Suit Serenaders. R. Crumb and his Cheap Suit Serenaders, and my guest Terry Zweigoff was featured on mandolin on that.
You were banjo mandolin, yeah.
Oh, banjo and mandolin.
No, it's a banjo mandolin. It's sort of a mandolin with a banjo head.
It's like they've been crossbred.
Yeah.
I think I should probably ask you what R. Crumb is really like, and we should, for our listeners who don't know his cartoons, they started really becoming popular in the late 60s.
Yeah, Zap Comics, Mr. Mm-hmm. Natural, Fritz the Cat.
They were very kind of sex and psychedelic inspired
cartoons.
Yeah,
he's a lot different than what he was like then. He's, you know, I met him right after that period in the early 70s, and he was, now he's a very conservative family man who loves his little daughter and wife, and you know, he lives out on a farm because he can't stand anybody. And I'm doing a film about him, so if anybody out there has any money, it's going to be a 90-minute feature documentary. His family lives here in town.
They do?
Yeah. He has a brother who lives here in town. His mother lives here in town. He has another brother in San Francisco, and I hope to have them all in the film because they're all really interesting people, and a couple of his brothers are really great artists in their own right. It has quite a bit of commercial potential, much more than this film I just did. Crumb is really big in Europe and France and Germany, sort of has this superstar sort of status that he doesn't have here. He's still sort of like this underground cult thing here at best. I don't know. He's sort of washed up in this country. But in Europe, he's real big. And I think the stuff he's drawing now is just as interesting as what he was drawing then, that he really made his fame. I think it's much better, much more interesting. It doesn't involve this sort of drug humor, you know, that's real dated.
Well, aside from album jackets, I don't think I've seen any of his recent work.
Let's see. Well, he does this weirdo magazine that I used to write advice to the Lovelorn column for and take photographs for, that he used to do a different comic strip in there, you know, ranging from a couple pages to 10 pages long in each issue. And his stuff's also published, wasn't this Coevolution Quarterly, various other sort of, unfortunately, underground comic book type magazines that don't get distributed very well. And the stuff that, you know, I don't especially like most of the other stuff that, you know, accompanies them in these magazines. But his stuff's great. I think he's like one of the important artists of the 20th century, certainly.
Do you dress up in any way for your concerts? Do you perform concerts?
Yeah, we all wear suits, cheap suits.
I get it. When you first really started listening to music of the 20s and 30s, did you drive around the country looking for old 78s?
Yeah, me and Crumb actually went on two record hunting trips, one in the early 70s and one in the mid 70s. Went all the way through the South into, you know, the most obscure places you could think of, the middle of Arkansas, Alabama, looking for rare country and blues 78s. And they're so rare. I mean, these records, the good stuff that, to my mind, was put out in the late 20s, early 30s, for some reason, it's a golden age of music. I don't like the stuff before that. It's usually too primitive sounding, and I don't like the stuff after that. It's too slick sounding. You know, it all came together in my mind in that period. And unfortunately, that period happened to be the Depression, and record companies were all going out of business, so a typical pressing of a record would be 100 records. And try to find, you know, it's like trying to find like some rare fossil or something. We had no idea. We figured, oh, we'll just get out of, you know, California, and we'll go like down to Alabama where this stuff originally was sold in stores, and it'll, you know, be easy to find, you know, real naive. It was impossible. You just find them. We found, you know, a handful of records in 3 months of going to every antique shop and flea market and knocking on people's doors. And, you know,
what do you do when you knock on someone's door?
You usually go to black neighborhoods and you knock on the door and you say, do you have any old blues records, you know, or jug band records? And you say, we pay $5 a piece for any of them. And most people either, you know, have them or they don't. And then usually you get in trouble with the cops or something. They think you're selling encyclopedias or something without a license. They never will believe that you're actually knocking on people's doors looking for old records. They think that you're, you know, trying to rob them or something. I don't know. It's a real thankless job.
So you only found a handful of records?
Yeah, that way. Actually, we later found out the best way to find these real rare records is from other collectors who had been active back in the 30s and 40s themselves, buying the stuff new when it came out. And, you know, trade them records that they like better, you know, like that were much more easy to find, stuff like Louis Armstrong Hot Fives and stuff.
A lot of that stuff has been reissued.
Yeah, most of the stuff's been reissued, which is why I'm to the point of probably even selling my 78 collections. It's worth so much money, it's crazy now, you know, records worth a couple thousand dollars each. So I can't afford to keep them. I can't afford the luxury. I'll soon have them on tape and sell off the originals at this point.
You've brought some reissues of recordings with you. And why don't we listen to some of them? The first one we're going to hear features the Noah Lewis Jug Band, but in the band is Yank Rachel.
Yank Rachel
was also featured
mandolin
in your movie.
Yeah. I got the money to do my film right after Carl Martin died, so I really didn't even have a band anymore of Martin, Bogan, and Armstrong, who'd been playing together for 55 years. And, you know, integral part of their band had just died, Carl Martin. So I searched the country trying to think of who else can I get in this band that can play a string instrument, that's old black guy with maybe a more rural approach to music who can play a string instrument. And weren't many guys left, I'll tell you. And I luckily found out that Yank Rachel was still alive. I wanted to meet the guy anyway. He was always a hero of mine just from hearing some old records he made, an incredible mandolin player. And lives in Indianapolis. I called him up. I said, you want to be in this movie? I'll pay you. Fly you to Chicago. He said, okay. So got him to Chicago the day before he started shooting, and I just put these guys together. Same with Ikey Robinson. None of these guys had ever met Bogan and Armstrong before, and they hit it off so well that it was great. You can tell that it almost looks like they've been playing together for 50 years.
Are they still in touch, do you know?
They don't stay in touch at all, which really shocked me, you know. It's like,
I guess you really worked some magic there.
These guys were really great friends by the time this movie was over, and they don't even bother to call each other, you know. It's really shocking to me.
Well, let's hear this recording that features Yank Rachel, and this is the Noah Lewis Jug Band. We're going to hear Ticket Agent Blues. Do you want to say anything about it? What do
you like
it so
much? One of my favorite records. It's an intense record. I don't know why it's intense. Or just listen to it. The guy singing is unbelievable. Noah Lewis sings and plays harmonica, and Yank Rachel's mandolin, and I guess, I don't know who else is on this record. I don't remember, some guitar player, piano player, but mandolin playing and the singing is great.
Okay, well, this is it. That was the Noah Lewis Jug Band, as recorded in 1930 from the collection of my guest Harry Zweigoff, who is the director and producer of the movie Louie Bluey, which is about Howard Armstrong, a 76-year-old mandolinist and violinist. And Terry plays mandolin himself and is especially interested in the string bands of the 20s and 30s. You know, a lot of the people who are listening to today, and certainly Howard Armstrong, who you made a movie about, were great musicians, and they never they never just made it commercially. They never had very well-known records.
Mm-hmm.
The records are hard to find now. There were small pressings, as you mentioned before. Did you get any insights in the shooting of your movie to why they just really never were able to make a very good living with their music?
Hmm. I guess in the early 30s already, like, the jukebox and radio were catching on pretty big, and live music at that point was pretty much becoming a thing of the past in bars and stuff. These guys were already, their styles, there were all these pockets of musicians all over the country, especially in the South, that had their own unique styles. These guys that would just, like, learn how to teach themselves how to play and sing, you know. Incredible variety in these old records you hear. And then once the radio came in, you know, just about everybody had a radio in the country, no matter how poor. It was a real cheap thing to buy. And people would hear somebody like Bing Crosby on the radio, you know, some white guy or even some black guy out in the country would hear Bing Crosby. And, God, he's a big hit, you know. He sounds better than me. I better start trying to imitate him, you know. That was one trend going on in music. I don't know why these guys never made it. I guess the kind of stuff most people wanted to hear was happier music or something. I don't know. I can't. You know, I never liked that stuff, so I can't tell why other people like it or don't like the stuff I like. I don't know.
The mandolinist who we just heard was playing some really crazy
Yank Rachel,
dissonant
yeah.
chords.
That's
on
right.
It.
Incredible genius.
He's still playing that way?
He still plays exactly the same way. One of the most important musicians of the 20th century. He's completely unknown by all but, you know, 100 people or something. He's, like, considered, oh, yeah, some old folk musician or something. He's, like, a great a genius as Picasso was, you know, I think. I think he's an incredible guy. It's too bad.
Let's get to another record that you brought with you. And this one's by the Memphis Sheiks. And we're going to hear He's in the Jailhouse Now, which is mm-hmm. a song that you have from archival footage
yeah.
very briefly in your movie. There were a bunch of Sheiks bands, weren't there? Wasn't
yeah.
the Mississippi Sheiks?
Mississippi
and
Sheiks. I think this band is actually the Memphis Jug Band recording under this pseudonym with maybe a few guys in the band different. A lot of these bands had alternating personnel depending on, you know, who was friends with who at the time and who could actually get the recording deal, who could get the recording session. They'd call up whoever was in town and who was free, and it's pretty loose aggregations of musicians. But this, I think this is basically the Memphis Jug Band.
What do you like about this record we're going to hear?
I like the tune. I even like Jimmy Rogers doing this tune. I think it's a good tune, and it's the best version of it I've ever heard.
Okay, and it was recorded in 1930? He's in
I
the jailhouse
so,
now.
Yeah.
I remember last election.
Yeah.
Jim Jones got in action.
Uh-huh.
Said he's voting for the man that paid the biggest price. Next day at the poll,
yeah.
he voted with heart and soul. But instead of voting once, he voted twice.
Uh-huh.
He's in the jailhouse now. Steady him staying at home. Let no white folks business alone. He's in the jailhouse now. You remember Henry Crewe? That soul that no good moves. He sold it to the police on the beat. Now Henry's feeling funny. Police give him mock money. He's got a ball and chain around his feet. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. The judge gave him 2 years, and Henry's shedding tears. He's in the jailhouse now. Play that thing. Went to every cabaret in town.
He bought lots of liquor. Trouble got thicker. Now son is jailhouse bound. He's in the jailhouse. In town until he played it with Benny's wife. And Benny cut him in the face. Now it's a disgrace. But now he's graveyard bound. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. Benny was his friend, place of letting that matter in. He's in the jailhouse.
That was the Memphis Sheiks. He's in the jailhouse now. As we were listening to that, Terry, I was telling you that I first heard the song from, as done by Roy Bookbinder, who was probably like 30 at the time, and had also learned it from records. And we were talking about the difference between the original bands and the kind of revival
the
bands.
The folk music revival.
Now, you're on both sides of that because you love the original.
I hate my own music. I think I stink. I think the Cheap Suit Serenaders stink.
Do you really?
And I think everybody else is even worse. You know, get these letters all the time from fans saying, oh, the Cheap Suit Serenaders, what a great band. And I'm in a little revival band myself. And, you know, I hate all that stuff. I think it's really a lost cause trying to imitate this stuff. My band hasn't been too active lately. We've all given up.
Do the other members of the band feel the way you do?
Some of them do, some don't. I think it's really ridiculous trying to imitate old country music. If you live in the city today, it's like a way of life that's vanished, and there's really no way to approximate that feeling or that style anymore without it just being real superficial.
Well, for me, that's what differentiates the good stuff from the bad stuff, is that the good stuff loves and respects the music and the musicians play it or reinterpret it or whatever. The stuff I don't like is the stuff that's either overly campy or strictly trying to imitate as opposed to...
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with that statement, but I'm even farther gone than you in that I don't even like the guys that sincerely love the music and are trying to reproduce it. I mean, I sincerely love the music my band does, and we're trying to imitate it. It just doesn't work, you know? It doesn't work. Never gonna... I mean, after you talk to some of these guys like Yank Rich and you see what kind of lives they led, you know, like they're out in the fields working in the sun all day. It's 100 degrees and they're like, you know, like bending over picking cotton or something. Their hands are like, you know, strong enough to crush like a, you know, like a golf ball or something. And they come home after 16 hours of work and they play to relax on the porch instead of like some Jewish intellectual like me and a bunch of other jerks who like try to you know, imitate this stuff, and they haven't worked an honest day's work in their lives. You know, it's not the same thing, you know.
So you're not playing anymore, huh?
I play in my living room once in a while with friends now. I don't like to perform too much unless it's at a dance. A lot of this blues music, quote unquote blues music, most people don't even know what blues music is. I got a call from this jerk that runs the San Francisco Blues Festival. Every year they got like one guy after another who's like in this blues festival. Nobody any good. There's a few guys left who can still play blues. Why not get these guys? Well, you know, we got so-and-so. And these guys they have are like, they sound like these bad imitators of B.B. King, you know. And they're, you know, but they're black guys, you know. So they say, oh, well, it must be real blues, you know. It's a bunch of bullshit. I don't know. It's all over but the crying. I don't know what to say.
Well, you're going to be presenting a concert Saturday night at the International House in conjunction with the film. And let me reintroduce my guest. He's Terry Zweigoff, and the band that he plays or played with, I'm not sure which tense to put it in, is Arkrum and his Cheap Suit Serenaders. And Terry's just done a movie on Howard Armstrong, who's a 76-year-old mandolinist and violinist who played for about 50 years with Ted Bogan and Martin Armstrong. And Martin Armstrong died shortly before the film documentary that Terry made. But Ted Bogan and Howard Armstrong are going to... What did I just
Carl
say?
Martin.
Carl Martin.
He said Martin Armstrong.
Right. So. But Ted Bogan and Howard Armstrong are going to perform this Saturday night in conjunction with the screening of Louie Bluey. That will be at the International House. The concert is at 8 o'clock. And there's a third musician playing with them.
I just heard on the way over here that he's not going to make it.
Oh,
so I guess,
really?
I guess Bogan and Armstrong are going to play longer. And Bogan and Armstrong are a shadow of what they used to be, but they're still better than any music in here live these days. You know, you should run down to hear these guys.
You're not going to sit in with them, right?
Hell no. After what I've just said, are you kidding?
So if you want to see the movie Louie Bluey or go to the concert Saturday night and need more information, you can call the International House at 387-5125, extension 222. That's 387-5125, extension 222, and the International House is at 3701 Chestnut Street. And you're going to try to make more movies, I take it.
Yeah, I'm like I said, I'm trying to raise money to do this R. Crumb documentary, and I've got some money from a home video company in advance. And then I'm working on a script for a film noir film, sort of a black and white film set in the 50s. The basic theme is this woman ruins a guy's life. Something that I can relate to, I guess. No, I'm only kidding. But so I've got two projects going and no money, so give me money. The place to send money
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for playing some of your records for us, too.
I'm sorry I was so negative about my own music.
Well, I guess...
But listen to these old 78s and these guys that are left.
And that said, I do want to tell you that we're going to have a concert on Monday that I think is going to really be a lot of fun, and I'd like to invite our listeners to come hear it. And performing is going to be Jane Voss and Hoyle Osborne. Jane's a singer, Hoyle's a pianist. And they do original material, contemporary material, and they also do some blues, vaudeville, and Tin Pan Alley songs from the 20s and 30s. And if you'd like to come, we're at 6th and Ray Streets, but you do have to call and make a reservation. Our phone number is 351-9200. That's 351-9200. And I hope you can make it, and if not, I hope you can tune us in. That's Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Also Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air, we're going to feature an interview with writer Rita Mae Brown. Well, it's 4 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Monday is going to be the 25th anniversary of Alan Shepard's first space flight, and this is the first manned space flight in America. And in recognition of that historic event, he spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. earlier today. He gave a retrospective of the U.S. space program and then responded to questions about the space shuttle disaster. We're going to hear that National Press Club address and the question and answer period which followed, tape delayed from National Public Radio.
Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust, for coverage of environmental issues in the Great Lakes region, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, and Software AG, worldwide supplier of advanced information management solutions. This program comes from NPR, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., this is another in the continuing series of programs from the National Press Club. I'm Frank Stachow. Today's guest speaker is former astronaut Alan Shepard.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Mary Kay Quinlan. I'm president of the club. I work for Gannett News Service. At 9:34 a.m. Eastern Time on May 5th, 1961, millions of television viewers watched as the spacecraft Freedom 7 sat ready for blastoff from Cape Canaveral, Florida. On top of a Redstone rocket, inside the small capsule, lay Alan B. Shepard, Jr., about to become the first American to venture into space. There was the now commonplace countdown, and then liftoff. During the flight...